We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined as always by Quinn Kesnick. And if that's an echo here in the background, I apologize. I'm in a new space. And in the background of Quinn's audio, we might hear some birds chirping. You're getting back to nature, huh, buddy?
I moved indoors, but yeah, I've been out in Woodstock, New York, pruning, trying to avoid the ticks.
Well, you've avoided the cicadas thus far, correct?
Yeah, they're not up here yet, but they'll be here in about 2 or 3 weeks would be my guess, as Maryland has about one more week left.
Well, all I know is that if you are allergic to seafood, you should not eat cicadas. That's the big headline that I ran across a couple weeks ago. Not allergic to seafood, but I'm also not going to eat cicadas. So for whatever that's worth, we are talking about, well, basically we're talking about what you, the listeners, want us to talk about. We appreciate all the positive feedback we've gotten the last couple weeks, particularly last week's podcast where we talked about Syracuse men's lacrosse staff hiring Gary Gate as its fifth head coach in its more than 100-year-long history, and we expect more news on that staff coming together early this week. Quint, as we refocus, coming away from the 2021 season and looking ahead to the 2022 season, what's top of mind for you?
Top of the mind for me is kind of wrapping up the action that we saw from Memorial Day weekend. I know in our last podcast, we talked about Virginia and Maryland in the championship game. Again, everywhere I go, people want to talk about that game and the way it finished. And then spinning storylines forward, whether it be Yale's new facility, Gary Gate hired at Syracuse. So what's he going to do with his assistant coaches? You know, I'm hearing all indications are that he's going to be hiring Dave Petromala as defensive coordinator, although that has not been finalized at the time of this taping. And then keeping an eye on the transfer portal, I think, is essential in this day and age. The shift of power can be sudden, it can be abrupt, and it can be monstrous for teams who win or lose in the portal.
So you mentioned Yale's facility, and it's a good place to start in the sense that we got a lot of questions about the Ivy League. So I'm just going to quickly run through them. We've got four. Adams, they're a varying tone, I'll say, in terms of positive, negative tone. Adams, 8720, wants to know, how far behind are the Ivies having lost this season? How bad is the damage? Mikey Moore, do you see how the Ivy League handled 2021 affecting their recruiting? Will kids go to a school in a conference that is quick to not give their athletes a chance to play? Crab Transplant, looking ahead to 2022, what Ivy survived the best through the pandemic / graduation / in enrolled students? And then Jeff Close, generally, what should we expect from the Ivy League in 2022? And with respect specifically to Yale's facility, can anyone in the Ivy League compete with that from a recruiting tool standpoint? Heck, can anyone in Division I compete with that? What's your take?
Well, facilities are, it's an interesting dynamic in lacrosse right now as places build up, whether it be, you know, Notre Dame building Arlotta, whether it be Michigan standalone, whether it be Hopkins in the Cordes Center. Originally, you know, Koskinen in Virginia was a lacrosse soccer facility that's done extremely well in terms of a venue. But I'm not sure that facilities ultimately are a big, they can be a game changer, yes, but do they determine national championships? Are they pulling in recruits? I don't know. I still think it comes down to people. You know, I think that's why you ultimately make your decision to attend a school. Teammates, coaching staff, people. Support is great. And we're seeing support now across the board at a lot of these places. So I don't think that differs. Obviously, the Yale facility is beautiful. It's amazing. Josai, Andy Shea, putting that together. And that's a feather in their cap. It's another reason to play lacrosse at Yale. Will it put that program over the top? I don't know. They're already there. And in terms of Ivy League winners going forward, I think they were the big winner in the fact that they had so many players withdraw and so many players not use a year of eligibility. And so many players now will come back and be able to play to their full capacity of 4 years. You know, that's an issue nationwide is the teams who benefited from grad students from 5th years, from keeping a team intact, seem to have an advantage. You know, it's Navy and Army are two teams that don't have that ability. And I think it's going to be hard for them to claw up into the top 10 when others are reloading and others continue to use the 5th year to their advantage.
It's interesting starting with the facility point because, you know, there's been such an influx of, or, you know, increase in the number of lacrosse-specific facilities over the last 10 to 15 years. And at times it has felt like an arms race. But I think the better way to think about it is less in terms of teams selling against each other and more in terms of programs continually increasing the quality of the value proposition of being a part of the program.
I agree. The student athlete experience, overall experience, has skyrocketed in the last decade.
100%. And I had this conversation in kind of an interesting dynamic. So I don't want to diverge into talking about Loyola, but I do think that their facility is emblematic of the role that building a lacrosse-specific facility plays in recruiting. And the question that I posed to somebody who was close to the program is, which do you think had a better impact or a greater impact on recruiting? Winning the 2012 National Championship or Pat Spencer's four-year run of being among the best players in college lacrosse? And the supposition was that Pat Spencer's stardom actually had a bigger role in recruiting than winning a national championship, which is kind of crazy to consider, but this individual agreed. And the point is that you can't promise a national championship, but if you can show someone not only that you have won a national championship, but also that you have produced a star in the sport of the biggest magnitude, then that recruit can imagine him or herself being the next version of that player. But, you know, slid into that answer was, I actually think the stadium had more to do with the increased quality of recruiting than anything else, because, you know, prior to the building the Ridley Athletic Complex, Loyola's home field was temporary bleachers on a big AstroTurf patch in the middle of campus with the locker rooms underneath the dining hall. It was charming and it was quaint, but it had no curb appeal, specifically compared to what they offer now. And I think that you can make a similar argument for Yale's facility. It you know, prior to the building of this, that program prided itself on how Spartan it was in so many respects. Right, you get dressed in a barn and you run out and whatever else. And now, you know, at the end line of their stadium field is this monument to all the success that Andy Shea has developed, and obviously the commercial success of you know, one of its most prominent alums. Is it going to translate into wins and losses? No, not directly. Indirectly, there's a lot of science in there that hopefully will help keep players on the field. From a recovery standpoint and a strength and conditioning standpoint. But I do think a lot of that stuff was happening in just a place that wasn't as well packaged. And I think that that's probably true at a lot of places that have built facilities recently and that are going to build facilities. Like, a lot of the work that gets done in those places was already being done. It was just being done in an older building.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with Spartan settings to train. In fact, some prefer it. You know, Muhammad Ali would escape to the woods of Pennsylvania for his training camp, and where he would chop wood after sparring sessions in the morning. So, but I think at the end of the day, you know, Yale's a place, and with that facility, where, look, again, lacrosse matters. We talked about this in our last podcast. Where does lacrosse matter, and who's showing you that it does? Who's going to maximize the experience from strength and conditioning to diet to academic support to postgraduate support? And you know, again, they're the haves and the have-nots, and the arms race is real. It's happening, and it benefits the student athlete.
So let me get my thought out there with respect to the Ivy League at large. I can imagine a scenario over the course of the recruiting class of 2023, maybe 5 to 10 guys who would otherwise have chosen to go the Ivy League route, choosing to go to Georgetown or Duke or wherever, Notre Dame. But my main point is, if you can play Ivy League lacrosse, you probably have had your sights set on lacrosse being a part of your opportunity to access the highest level academic and social network opportunities that were going to be available to you upon graduating from high school. For a really long time, right? The people in your life have helped you understand the role that
the value,
studying yes. played in hand in hand with playing lacrosse. And if you were really laser focused on lacrosse at the expense of your academics, you probably weren't going to play at an Ivy League institution anyhow. I struggle with this idea that the university presidents and conference administrators' unwillingness to play in the face of a pandemic equates to both a long-term lack of support when there are so many other kind of examples of support that have been shown. And it's not to say that it's directly linear, and it's not to say that there aren't people on campus who don't like sports. All of those things are true, but all of those things have been true. And yet, in 2020, we had the most successful Ivy League lacrosse season that we had had in 10 or 15 years. So in the same way that in 2020, those teams were successful in spite of all the challenges, I think that'll persist because I don't see any reason that the value of going to an Ivy League school to play lacrosse has gotten worse in the last 18
months. But it's a tiebreaker that they'll lose in the eyes of recruits.
But they'll only lose it to a handful of schools that can offer an equivalent academic experience. And my point is that there's such a small number of those that if they lose those head-to-head battles, they won't lose them in great numbers. There are roughly 70 spots in an incoming class along the seven Ivy League men's lacrosse playing schools. And there are only two or three other schools that can offer a similar academic experience that don't have the same problem, right? Georgetown wasn't on campus in the fall of 2020.
I agree with that, Terry. And you know, the other factor I think for student athletes is what type of college experience you want overall. You know, do you want big time football or basketball? Do you want to be able to go to a Georgetown basketball game? Do you want to be able to go to an ACC football game? Do you care about concerts coming to campus? You know, the overall experience, I think, weighs heavily. And the Ivies, it's a different experience. And obviously, I would completely agree with your point. I think that the hurt is minimal, but even a minimal hurt is significant nowadays where the race is so tight.
That's a good point. Yeah, you're right. And you can look at these as like trend-based dynamics, right? And say the trend is going to be a 2 to 5% decrease, assuming that it is going to decrease. And that 2 to 5% might in aggregate end up, you know, across the four teams that are in the top 20, it could cost them a total of 20 positions in the poll. And it could cost them an at-large berth in the NCAA tournament.
Exactly. If it cost you a goal, one goal, that's a lot. That's a lot nowadays. That's how everyone's cratching and sclawing. I mean, you give me four goals and I can change the entire playoff bracket of what we had 15 playoff games are there. There's eight, four, 15 games. You give me five goals. I can restructure and come up with how many different champions could you get if you give me a swing of a goal here and a goal there.
Well, given that three of the quarterfinal games ended in overtime, you can change a lot.
Correct. So those little things do matter.
So anything else to say about the Ivy League or shall we move on?
No, I'm excited to see how they bounce back, you know, and what type of fall I would, you know, they got to hit the ground running. There's some catch up to do in terms of player development, on-field reps. You know, that's something that can't be like how much goes into like comparing Virginia's season or Big Ten season, a 12-game slate, let's say, or a 10-game slate compared to no games, no practices. I mean, just the amount of think about Denver and their ambitious schedule this season. Like how much residual value is there in that versus a team that was on the sideline for a full year?
And not only that, but also I think you can't have this conversation without pointing out that Jerry Byrne and his staff were in the midst of their first year on campus when the pandemic hit, and there's been a change in head coach at Cornell since. So you take, you know, the kind of upheaval of five classes in most of these institutions where a lot of kids withdrew. You take the fact that they won't have played a competitive lacrosse game in 22 months when they play their first next competitive lacrosse game. And you know, two-sevenths of them, for all intents and purposes, have completely new coaching staffs. Unbelievable change relative to the last time that we would have seen these seven teams play in March of 2020.
Yeah, no, and again, everyone's challenge was different this year. Some had falls, some had partial falls, some had, again, 15-game schedules, some had 10-game schedules. So this is still very much a work in progress, and I'd just be interested to see how, within the rules, how these teams approach their preseason and training camps.
It is now officially Maverick May Madness on InsideLacrosse.com. And the new Maverick EKG shoulder pads and chest protector are here for all players. Get upgraded performance protection that meets the new Noxy safety standards. Shop the whole line on lax.com/EKG.
So the next cluster of questions we got was about Syracuse. You mentioned that the consistent report has been that Dave Petromala will join the staff as a defensive coordinator. Adams 8720 wants to know what Petro needs to do differently relative to the end of his Johns Hopkins tenure in order to find success at Syracuse. And Crab Transplant would like to know, does Syracuse expect a return to the Final Four in 2022?
Immediately? I don't know if that's going to be possible, but certainly that's a goal. And you listen to Gary's press conference, you know, this is a team that wants to be perennially in the run for championship weekend and to win titles. That's why they made the change. You know, it really struck me the other day. We talked about Coach Desko's impact, but really, I mean, you could point to his emergence as an assistant coach at Cuse had really been the turning point in that program. Roy Simmons had coached there for a decade, you know, going into 1983 when they won the title, and Desko emerges as the brains behind the operation, so to speak, and his ability to recruit the Yorktown area, Westchester County, and then West Jenny specifically led to the emergence of that program. So I felt like we gave Coach Desko a lot of respect, but the more I thought about it, the more impact it became clear to me that he had on that program. Now, turning forward for Cuse, you know, there's whispers of cultural. You know, is there culture where it needs to be? Is there culture behind the scenes as strong as a place like Virginia? Is it as strong as a Maryland culture? Is it as strong as some others that we've seen? And Gary will do a good job in identifying ways to strengthen that. And he will build a right culture. I'm sure of that. In terms of adding Coach Petromala, if in fact that happens, and I would point a question to our fans. In the history of sports, all levels, has there ever been a 1-2 punch in coaching staffs that equates to this group? Like in terms of their on the field accolades in any sport, like has, again, Michael Jordan coached with LeBron? No, like I can't think of a duo in any sport at any time of any era that even comes close. It would have to be an old-time baseball tandem with like a Yogi Berra and one of his assistants. But just to think that the two best players in their position, potentially in the history of the game, are on the same coaching staff is it's really mind-boggling. And try to compare it to another sport, because I can't come up with another one. I can't even come up with a clear second.
What do you think is the most important thing to coaching successful defenses in 2022?
Well, I think it's defending the shot clock. It's being disruptive. And we've seen Maryland's defense be very good over the course of a season. But I just think on Championship Monday, they weren't as disruptive. What did they do to make Virginia uncomfortable? Nothing. They were on the receiving ends of all the punches in that game. Okay. Maryland's offense was disruptive and caused people all sorts of problems. But Maryland defensively, it was almost as if they were in reactionary mode. Who can be a defense? And Virginia's shown that they can be a defense that kind of dictates the terms of engagements with their length and their poles. And they don't want to really slide to their poles. They'll support their shorties, but they don't want to go to their poles. And that seems like it's disruptive. Who's got the ability? Notre Dame at times can be disruptive to the way you operate with their adjacent double teams. So I would think, again, being solid, not giving up bad goals. I think crease play defensively is an epidemic across the country. I don't think it's coached at the high school or club level or emphasized very much, that off the ball inside play. And this year in particular, I saw teams surrendering all sorts of easy, cheap goals because of poor fundamentals on the inside that can be remedied, that can be taught, that can be repped. And then, you know, the quality of your shorties, I think, really determines a lot of the outcomes on defense. They're the first line of defense. And if you're constantly in damage control of their performance, then you got issues on defense, because if those guys can't hold up, look at Hopkins in the last decade. It's really been a struggle. When your first line of defense, having bad corners in football, well, your safeties have to support them, and the ball gets out too fast, so your defensive ends don't have the power rush. But if you've got great corners that take away those first looks, then all of a sudden your DNs are getting the quarterbacks, causing turnovers, causing havoc and disruption. Your safeties can blitz because you don't need to rotate over the top. So I equate great short stick play with having options on defense.
It feels like there's, and you can do this with a lot of conversations, but a relatively stark divide between two philosophies. So the Jerry Byrne popularized philosophy of, we are going to disregard matchups, we are not going to be overly matchup conscious, and we are going to slide consistently to certain areas, certain situations, regardless of who is involved. And in so doing, where you're going to create a predictable decision-making environment for our players, because players making the wrong decision and not knowing what their teammates are going to do is the leading cause of giving up goals. And then the other side of the coin is, I would put it into a Duke or a Loyola style defense, where our goal is not to slide. Our goal is not to rotate. It is to turn Dodgers back as consistently as possible. And I don't think either exists. If it's a scale of 1 to 10, there is no 10 and there is no 1. I think there's, you know, teams that operate kind of in the 2.5 realm and then teams that operate in the 7.5 realm. And when you talk about culture, the word that comes to my mind is identity. A big part of, so culture is typically referred to as something like, it's all the positive attributes wrapped up into one. It is the chemistry-based off-field reason that we are successful, whether that means wins or graduation or whatever the case may be. And I think that along those lines, having an identity for how you want to play at both ends of the field, in the middle of the field, whatever, is the first step toward finding success. Because if you're straddling two identities, or if you struggle to be able to explain your identity clearly, then I think, you know, you made the comment last week talking about large rosters and how difficult it is to practice with 60 guys on your team. You know, say 26 of them are defenders, well, then you've got 26 independent thinkers that are trying to understand what it is that we as a group, the 6-7 of us that are on the field at once, are trying to do. And to make that as clear as possible and to make the answers to the questions that stem from that as intuitive as possible, to me, that's the challenge of coaching. And so yes, your point is really well taken with respect to the shot clock has totally changed pathways toward being successful. Because to the point about being reactive, right? You said Maryland's defense is reactive as opposed to taking the challenge to the offense. I would argue that defense is always reactive in every sport, right? And that's why it's so much more physically taxing. But in the areas when you can impose your will, when you can take away the thing that the offense wants to do proactively, yes, that separates good from great. In some instances, it'll separate losing from winning. But one of the things that the shot clock has done is it's totally changed the incentive structure for offenses, right? It used to be play for the best shot because there was no impediment, right? Now it's play for the best shot in 80 seconds. And if that best shot comes with 25 seconds left in the shot clock, then take it, because we have no guarantee that we're going to get another better shot in 25 seconds. And so in the pre-shot clock point of time, defenses could logically be structured in order to just prevent that best shot from ever emerging. Well, now they have to be prepared to disrupt that shot that the offense identifies as being the best one. And if it's with 25 seconds left in the shot clock, like, sometimes just forcing the offense to shoot makes the ball go in. And so I just think about it in that context. Like, in my opinion, it is not an overstatement to say that the shot clock should have forced every single defensive coordinator to just completely whiteboard their philosophy and start from scratch. And if you ended up in a very same place, very similar place to where you started from, that's fine. You just need to do it in the context of we have to play for 80 seconds.
Yeah, here's a trend alert. 2019 playoffs, 2021 playoffs. The further we got in the bracket, it seemed to me like teams got out of the sliding business because their opponents at that level are really, really good. Guys who can draw double teams, spin the ball, and generate high quality shots. And so I know defensive coordinators want to be as multiple as possible. I know what it feels like to say, hey, let's force that guy righty. Let's force him lefty. Let's turn him. Let's do this for him. Like, that all works. But that works at the pro level. That works in the NFL. I'm not sure that works in college football as well. You got to get good at something. And I think at the end of the day, what we've seen in the last two playoff runs is the less sliding we do, the better. The more guys we can put on an island. If we got two guys, I know we don't have to slide to. That's great. If we got three or four, wow, we're in good shape here. And if we make it a one-on-one game, if we recruit great players and make it a one-on-one game without ball movement, guess what skyrockets? Our goalie save percentage will skyrocket. When he's asked to make shots with players on the run, forced to weaker areas without ball movement. And you've seen now in the shot clock era how goalies have been more of an impact, especially in NCAA tournament games.
So I think that this question will build on that a little bit, but it's looking at it more from the offensive end. Durskib wants to know, is it just me, or with box-style techniques, are the stud two-handed players, Schreiber, the Powells, Rabel, Harrison, a dying breed? Championship weekend felt like a lot of guys favoring one hand heavily. And I just want to add this one to it because I think that it correlates closely. Alex Siegel wants to know, did you see his pro success coming? Maybe I didn't watch enough Cuse this year, but I'm surprised he's been so dynamic for the Cannons. I'll get to the Rafus point in a second, but why don't you start? What were your thoughts on the two-handedness of offensive players in college lacrosse this season?
Well, I think we have seen more half-field offense that you know, whether it's a pairs, you know, initiating from a side where you can be a one-handed player. I've also seen, you know, the influence of the box where guys are doing amazing things with one hand, and it's not a hindrance. That the behind the back, that the shovel shots, that their ability to keep the stick in one hand is, you know, why take a weak-handed shot when you're a 12% shooter instead of taking a lesser shot with your strong hand where you may be an 18% shooter? So I think it all comes down to more creativity in the game. I think at the pro level, you know, we can talk about this. I think you're going to ask us about the shortening of the field, but you know, that game looks like box lacrosse more and more. I can't argue, but again, at the end of the day, Connor Schellenberger is a two-handed ambidextrous player, and he was the best player in the tournament. Matt Moore is mainly right-handed, but he scored a big left-handed goal. Jared Bernhardt had you know, most of his success as a right-handed player, but he certainly had a left as well. And there's some midfielders that I can draw upon who, you know, Loyola's guys seemed in the tournament to be able to, you know, post up and use either hand. So I'm a big believer in keeping the stick in your strength as much as possible. But I think that too often at the youth level, we try to force feed. You got to have a weak hand. You got to have a weak hand. You got to have a weak hand. And I'm not sure I'm not sure that should be the starting point for the sport.
So my attitude is the sport has become more two-sided. And I think this is what you were trying to say with respect to, you know, pairs offenses initiating on both halves of the field.
Yeah, they're like, you draw a line through the middle of the field almost nowadays.
Exactly. And what that means is there are really only two guys, you know, potentially one up top and one behind, and potentially only one behind, who kind of need to be two-handed in order to be, you know, more two-handed than I'm able to, as we're circulating the ball around the field, catch with my left and throw with my right or vice versa. in terms of being dangerous, how many guys in the field have to be two-handed?
More wing-initiated offenses mean that if I'm on the righty wing and I can beat my guy topside and score right-handed, that's a really good shot. That's a great shot. I'm getting to the middle of the field. My other move is to duck underneath and then keep the stick in my right hand, duck underneath and bring it back for a right-handed shot. So again, wing initiation is typically one-handed. It can be, it's easily, more easily done one-handed. X initiation, as you're saying, and top of the box initiation is best if you're two-handed because you got a two-way go in those scenarios. So I completely agree with your point. And if fans would draw a line down the center of the field and realize that teams are mostly initiating from the wings nowadays, wings through X or wings through top, and then they attack the backside, that's why I think you're seeing more one-handed type players.
And it makes sense that if you're a developmental player, if you don't project to be the best player on your college team, then you should focus on your strengths, because whether you're righty or lefty, there's just going to be more available spots to get on the field by being in a two-man game on either side of the field than there is being, you know, the guy at X who's responsible for both, you know, facilitating the ball's movement from one side to the other, and also and doing that, you know, in an attacking setting, and then also pressuring both sides of the crease from behind, right? There's only one guy in the field on each team whose responsibility could be to do that. And sometimes there are zero guys on the field whose responsibility is that. So I think it's just a numbers game in terms of what's going to give me the best chance to contribute to my team. And
yeah, play to your strengths. And then if they're good enough, if there's a spark enough there, the coach will put you in a position to utilize those strengths. You can't be the jack of all trades nowadays. It doesn't seem. That's a very rare quality. That's a Harrison quality. That's a Schreiber quality. That's a rare quality.
And I want to pick up on the Rafus point, because I think he's a good example of it in the sense that he's just continued to evolve over the course of his career. And I think that some of the things he did early on his arrival at Syracuse are part of the reason that he's finding success in the pro level, specifically around the notion of two-handedness, right? He was much more left-hand dominant early in his career than he was this season. He was also much more of a pass-first player. He ran out of the box more as a midfielder early in his career. The player that we saw him grow into this season for Syracuse was a two-handed behind the goal initiator who was able to score and assist nearly in equal measure. But now what we've seen him revert to on a team that has Lyle Thompson and Paul Rabel on it is the middy out of the box who is attacking a short stick and is facilitating, but then can go get his own. And Brandon Childs was on our PLL Happy Hour podcast, the York head coach, who has, I believe, done some assistant coaching at the pro level as well. And his point was that those are the types of players, your fifth and sixth best player, can be the determining factor in your success on the field. Because to your point about the first line of defense is your source of D-Mitty, it's also your first line of offensive initiation so frequently are the guys who are getting covered by a short stick. They're going to be the ones that are going to have to set the picks in order to switch the matchups in order to get your best player matched up onto a short stick. And in the instances in which they don't and they have to initiate, they're going to be the ones that are doing it. And I think Rafus's success so far with the Cannons this season is a reflection of both the fact that his skill set is diverse enough because of what it started at and what it evolved into, and his role on the team is such that he can do what he's being asked to do. So, you know, I would say that it's in some respects less about the quality of the player and more about the player's role fit. Not just in this instance, but typically.
Yeah, the matchup he can capitalize on as the third receiver. But Stephen's trajectory and his career path is very interesting. I mean, obviously a Holy Cross transfer, got the extra year. So at the college level, he was a little older. And as you said, originally a passer, somewhere along the line, a toughness and a confidence clicked where he was taking the ball to the inside, to the dirty areas. And with that confidence then, opened up all sorts of options. And he is just a you know, a late bloomer, so to speak, who's come into his own. And it's great to see him to get off to so successful of a start, where it feels like his skill set really complements and really works well with the rest of that group.
So we've got a couple of questions that are very broad, and then we've got a ton of PLL questions that we could potentially get through rapid fire as we finish up. There are three broad questions, two about college, one about high school, that I want to get to. Chris Yastrzemski wants to know, when will we see the next wave of expansion in D1 men's college lacrosse, and how can the rise of PLL in popularity help the college game make that wave larger? And then I think that this relates to it. Colin Carissi wants to know, with the addition of lacrosse in the Olympics, which is not yet formal and done, but is heading in that trajectory and we had another positive moment last week with World Lacrosse receiving full recognition, or getting it recommended by the executive board that the membership vote for full recognition of World Lacrosse by the IOC. Well, when we see, what does college lacrosse need to do to take the next step in terms of becoming a mainstream sport? I know that this is a topic that you've got a lot of strong feelings on, so I will let you go.
Well, you know, I think that the Olympic point is very valid. You know, the other thing that happened this spring was the Stanford reinstating a lot of their non-revenues in their Olympic sports, including wrestling. And we've always had the dream of Stanford having a men's lacrosse team. You know, Boston College winning on the women's side certainly bodes well for them adding a men's team. And you think about
this. You say adding, but it's not adding. It's reinstating. Well,
reinstating their men's program, as I'd like to see done at, you know, New Hampshire, William and Mary as well. But
Michigan State.
Getting back to BC, you think about the red bandana and everything that's meant to that university. A lacrosse player. He was the stick doctor of the BC lacrosse team. And how could they not have a men's lacrosse program after what's gone on there in the last decade? So that's a positive. You know, again, rumblings down south at Florida State. But I think the Olympics is a long-term massive, even though the format's a little different. It's a long-term massive positive push. And I'm hoping that there's some Power Fives, you know, around the corner. I'd love to see Michigan State. I'd love to see someone else. Northwestern now with a leadership change at their athletic director position. They have a women's program. Why not a men's program out in Chicago? I would love to see an addition in the ACC, and I'd love to see an addition in the Big Ten.
There is, if this is a beat, right? It's a traditional reporter word, right? Like I'm on the court beat for my local daily newspaper. If I have a beat, there's not one that I have focused more time and energy on in my 13-year inside lacrosse career than the expansion of the sport at the Division I men's level. And so when you look at the historical trends and see that the Power Fives are the outlier, right? I mean, it's been fortunate, right, that in my time, if I had worked in inside lacrosse at any point between 1981 and 2011, I wouldn't have seen a Power Five ad. In fact, I would have seen a couple of Power Fives drop men's lacrosse. But in the last 10 years, two have added in Michigan and Utah. I mean, that's incredible progress relative to, like I said, the preceding 30 years. But the majority of growth has come at small, private, enrollment-driven institutions, predominantly in the Southeast. So when I look at where are the programs, where are the universities that match that profile that should take a look at this sport, in large numbers, they're really focused on the West Coast. When you look at the middle of the country, most of the non-Power 5 programs are state institutions. And there is so much different about the financial outlook of state institutions than private institutions that it's a much different conversation that, with very few exceptions, we haven't seen be successful. So I look at the West Coast Conference with the likes of Santa Clara, Loyola Marymount, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Pepperdine as the large opportunity for men's lacrosse expansion. The problem is, though, whoever the first adopter would be
You know, you hear about how Denver spends 12,000 miles a year or whatever it is on an airplane.
The cost, there, Terry.
It'd be 25% larger. It has to be two, three, four programs making the decision collectively. And in order for that many different minds to come together on a big risk like this, there needs to be a wide-scale strategy. And right now, that strategy just, it doesn't exist. There isn't the stakeholder that has planted their flag and said, I'm going to make this my priority. And it should be a priority, in my opinion. I don't think that there's anything that could be more beneficial for the sport than something like that. Because because the motivation for those types of institutions to add is different and clearer than it is for Power Five programs. They have motivations. They just aren't as clear and they aren't as front and center, right?
Well, let me ask you a question then. Sunbelt. Who can use the Sunbelt as a landing spot, as a launching pad?
Well, so you're referring to the ASUN.
The next year's new conference.
The answer is anybody. And that is so important because the ASUN, led by Commissioner Ted Gumbart, is so different relative to every other conference commissioner in their outlook. Typically, a conference's responsibility is to serve its members. Gumbart has made it clear in instituting the ASUN for men's lacrosse, which will coexist with the Southern Conference, that their goal is to serve these programs that don't have a conference home.
Right. So they're going to become the Ellis Island or the hostel, so to speak, of potential growth. Why I think it's the Sun Belt, maybe for my football work, but ASUN is so important here.
No question about it. I mean, conference affiliation and the ability to compete for an AQ are, they are at worst the third and fourth most important aspects to recruiting and potential competition behind the quality of the head coach and the quality of the academic offering, right? And I think that they are more important than your facility. They're more important than your athletic and academic support. If you can offer an opportunity to play in the NCAA tournament, think about how it is transformational to a program.
And I have a schedule. I debut with an AQ and a schedule set, which is I think a huge plus when we've seen the struggles of a Utah to fill out their slate, the Hamptons issues being out of a conference, place like Robert Morris flip-flopping, the issues of Cleveland State and some of the canceled programs we've seen like Furman.
Sebastian Price wants to know, how do you see the state of high school lacrosse in the country in the areas of growth and development and exposure? What challenges is the game face in these areas as well? The prevalence of the club showcase team and tourney are the standard for recruiting now. Will this lead to players' families devaluing the experience of playing for their high school team and coaches as a key ingredient of their trajectory? What are some of the FAQ? Well, we'll save that last part for after we get through this. Your point of view on high school lacrosse in areas of growth and development relative to club and showcases?
I mean, I'm a huge proponent of the high school lacrosse experience. I think for a lot of reasons, you know, the economic barriers to being part of a club are significant. And if we want this sport to be all inclusive and everyone to have an opportunity, then growth at the high school level is most important. And I would encourage D1 coaches to, you know, again, these guys talk a certain language, and yet then they go to certain events that cater to the upper scale clubs, the high pay events, instead of trying to get out during the spring and watch more high school games, and try to fertilize and seed, public high school lacrosse, and you know that's what the game got its great boost from when it hit in Long Island and Howdy Myers in the 70s, and the same in Central New York in the late 70s when West Jenny and all the schools up there, and I don't know, that was kind of a renaissance era for the game public school lacrosse, multi-sport athletes. And now, unfortunately, it's skewed to what is going to be almost impossible to reverse, but this this club dominated sport like soccer.
So this is gonna sound like a rant, and it is. But feel free to interrupt whenever I get too far off the rails. So I think we are in an in-between period of time in the standpoint of college recruiting. But I also think even more than that, we are overdue for what I would call a cultural revolution. For 20 years, from say 1995 to 2015, lacrosse was touted as a more accessible way to get a better college admissions opportunity or some sort of tuition reduction. And the reason to play lacrosse was being pitched by some as transactional. My opinion is that, number one, probably did more harm than good.
Yeah, and it number wasn't two. I was before that, Terry. So correct. It was not transactional. It was local. It was sport your brothers played in the high school, your friends played for the junior high. We had a rec league team. It was anything but transactional. Go on.
So I think that because of the conversation that we just finished, right, there has been growth at the Division I level, but it hasn't kept up to speed on the boys' side, at least a little bit more so on the girls' side, with in ratio the popularity of high school and youth lacrosse, meaning that more players are competing for fewer spots comparatively. And so as a result, the opportunity, right, the conversion rate, to use a financial term, on that transaction is decreasing. So when I say there needs to be a cultural revolution, parents need to understand that the reason to play lacrosse is because your son or daughter likes playing lacrosse, whether it's because they enjoy the stick and the ball, whether they enjoy being a part of a team, whether they enjoy the physical development and emotional development that occurs as a result of playing the sport. Those are the three reasons to play, not because you think it's going to lead to a better life. It may, but there's no guarantee for sure, and there's a smaller likelihood than there was 20 years ago. The reason I say we're in an in-between phase in recruiting is because I think that the last 18 months of experience has the potential to change how college coaches recruit in a way that will probably be pretty hidden, but be more meaningful than anything that's happened, certainly since the rule change in 2017 that put a cap on early recruiting, and I would say since the trend of early recruiting start. And that is the ability or the willingness to recruit exclusively via video. Because if a greater number of coaches spend more time watching video than they do being on sidelines at events, that should have a knock-on effect of swinging the pendulum of value and power from the club summer recruiting back to mm-hmm. the spring.
Because, to anybody, because everyone has access to film.
And no one has a every college coach will say, I would rather see you in the context of your high school team, because we know that from a game planning standpoint, you and your opponent, whatever, all that sort of stuff. But the problem is that there is this offsetting value of recruiting via video or evaluating via video versus evaluating in person. And there's also this perceived obligation to be at these events, because the notion is that if you are not, you are not working hard. And I will point out that there is a pretty strong correlation between the top ranked programs, coaches being some of the least seen on sidelines, which is just, you know, kind of a little nugget, so to speak. I don't think that the pendulum will ever swing fully in one direction. It's just about the balance of, instead of going to this event on this Thursday in mid-July, I'm going to spend a day in the office and I'm going to watch 20 high school games. Like, if more guys are willing to make that decision, then that could have a positive effect for the role yes. of high school lacrosse in recruiting.
I like it. I use the Elijah Gash example as a young man who was recruited off of video, Scott Meyer finding him out of Green Bay, Wisconsin. Those are stories that I hope continue to grow. The other thing I would say is, you know, so that gives hope. You know, that gives hope for the kid in Arizona. That gives hope for the kid in Portland, Oregon. That gives hope for the kid in Northern California. And, you know, from the college standpoint, I don't know. Does everyone fish the same lake during the summer? You know, like, aren't you best like fishing a different river and a different pond from everybody else?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a social side of it too, where guys enjoy it, right? And I think, so there's just a lot of competing factors that come into play. And I just don't think we should take for granted any particular way in which it's going to settle out. I think that it'll take a couple of years in order to see what folks think was successful.
Yeah.
And what
my last point there would be, Terry, the football. You know, the head injuries, concussions, and the impact. What is lacrosse's potential to capitalize on the way football is trending in the eyes of a lot of young parents?
All right. Like I said, a handful of PLL questions that we can rip through quickly. I'm just going to lay them all out. You can pick whichever ones you want to respond to. Chris Tahansky wants to know, I'm not sure I like the shorter field and the face-offs are a bit of a brawl. Diane Basile would like to know, how long does PLL stick with the barnstorming model before affiliating with cities? Nifty
These are
Q,
tough questions.
What does success look like for the PLL in 2 to 4 years, in 5 to 10 years? How optimistic are you that they can achieve their goals? And Alex Siegel, who asked the Stephen Rafis question, also asked, are you surprised to see the decrease in emphasis for two-way middies in the PLL? In 2019, I felt like there was so much chatter around having two-way middies because of the threat of transition. I'll take this one first. I thought that the biggest thing that happened, and you can see this in terms of the betting lines, the over-unders between 2019 and 2020, was the emphasis on transition defense. And it seems pretty remarkable in context subsequently that it took a full offseason in order for coaches to identify that this was going to be the most important thing you could do to increase your chances of winning. But basically, and you've spoken about this previously, the reduction of 10 yards seems like it's had the inverse effect from what was hoped for or intended, which was because long pole shooting twos is the likely outcome of transition offense, whereas scoring a goal in the last ten seconds of a shot clock is almost certainly always going to be a one. It is so much more worthwhile for PLL's teams, PLL offenses, to sub off and set up some sort of ride to avoid a fast break going the other way, that I think that's why transition scoring was down. That's why scoring was down from 2020 to 2019, or 2019 to 2020, and then why that trend has persisted so far in most games, with the exception of some of the blowouts in 21. It's a function of emphasizing transition defense and preventing long poles from taking twos.
The trailer break should be there. The 5-on-4, 6-on-5. Kick back to the second man in the rush or third man in the rush, the long pole, as you said, for the outside shot. It's really a low risk play. Shoot for the corners. If you miss, it's maintain possession. If you hit a two, it's a bonanza. So I agree with that strategy. The one thing that I kind of notice is it seems like it's a little more like red zone lacrosse. And you know, you think about football, it's every possession's like, we're in the red zone, so let's bring in our goal scorers. Let's, you know, and so we're seeing more teams dressing all sorts of attack rosters, 6 attackmen, fewer shorties, a couple middies who can go both ways. And it's more resembling indoor than I thought it would. And I don't necessarily, you know, there's things that go on in the middle of the field that I think are really cool. You know, you think about the riding and clearing and what that impact with the timing clock now at the college level, and how important that ride backs have been, and how important the 10 man. And that's been so refreshing to see in the last 2 or 3 years, how the riding and clearing, Virginia struggled to clear in the semis and the finals, the 10 man ride in North Carolina. I just, maybe it's nuanced and maybe I'm the moron there, but I find those aspects to be very enjoyable.
With respect to the PLL's kind of like growth and transition, I mean, one of the things that comes with the way that Paul and Mike have spoken about the league as a startup is the notion of where is this investment going and how does it create a liquidity event? Again, to use a term that comes from that vernacular. And I've said this previously, I always thought that the best opportunity and one of the things about the 2019 strategy that made the most sense was the prospect of selling franchises to MLS owners because they own venues and they have spent 25 years investing in future sport potential. I do think that that possibility continues to exist. I think I would expand the net to include USL investors. But one of the things that we've seen as they've continued to diversify their capital table, you know, most recently adding the Crafts and bringing on an entity that's led by Doc O'Connor is, you know, and then obviously resulting from the merger last fall that brought Rob Hale to the table as well. You know, they basically have, you know, 8 to 10 individuals who are kind of proxies for owners if at some point they kind of wanted to split this apart. And when that would happen is when you would see a transition to team based, you know, geo-based,
yeah.
Which they've always said is the goal. They've just offset that by saying right now it's not the smartest strategy. The smartest strategy is it continues to be identifying markets with potential and going to them. And then if they don't work out, not returning. Right. And so,
it's a fascinating business study, Terry. And it's very complex and difficult to figure out. I mean, covering Major League Lacrosse for 20 years, I was always saying to myself, we need to barnstorm. And the league did a little in the early days. There was a game in Portland. There was a game in Seattle that I think had 8,000 fans back in 2004. It was the Bayhawks went out there. There were games in Lisle, you know, outside of Chicago, which was dreadful. There were games in you know, one-offs. And I'm a believer in those one-offs. I believe that this game should be taken to non-traditional areas. But I'm a believer that you need to have some kind of financial success. So you got to be in some of the hotbeds and more than once a summer, maybe 2 or 3 times a summer. So you're coming to Baltimore and playing at Hopkins. You'll come back later in the summer and play at Towson or Loyola because you need revenue coming in. You got to play in front of 5,000 to 10,000 people on occasion. You can't be playing empty stadium lacrosse all the time because you lose momentum. You want to go to places that where we can do okay this year. Next year, we think we can do well. In 3 years, we think we can do great. And so all those factors you got to put on the table. And this is not easy at all. The one thing I sense this year is when they hit a market, it seems like it's a little oversaturated. It's a little much for even for me as a hardcore fan. You know, having a young daughter, what games am I going to be able to watch? Well, I don't get Peacock, which is a strike one. Saturday afternoons typically are going to be busy. You know, like Sunday nighttime slot would be the best for us.
Yeah.
You know, and I got to see more Sunday night. That's destination viewing. I tell you, I'd be locked in every single week without conflict, even in the depths of travel summer and crazy summer. You know, for some reason, it seems like Sunday night would work. And I like the barnstorming. I like going to new places. I like making new fans. It's hard sell, and you need some people on the ground in all those cities to really help you promote and sell tickets.
Well, we're nearly an hour into this podcast, and I feel bad that we haven't brought up the tragic passing of Graham Harden, a North Carolina alum, a New Canaan native, a great, great lacrosse player, a promoter of the game in one of those outpost markets that we talked about, a high school, particularly a girls' high school lacrosse coach in Cincinnati, who had a long battle with ALS. And this past weekend, Quinn, I know you know a little bit more about him than I do, so I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, what a scrapper. I remember covering him, played against him, but then covering him in the 91 North Carolina championship run. I was doing radio back then with Bill Tanton and Howard Marsh. We went up to the dome and covered the semis and the finals. Had a great dinner up there with Bill Wallace. But so Graham was this defender, close defender, probably played some wings on faceoffs, but he led the Tar Heels and grounders that year. 86 ground balls for a defender, a national defender of the year. Years later, I think we played against each other in club. USA tryouts. It was like the Sunday morning, the last tryout, the last scrimmage of seven. And there I am in a goal, and Graham's my defender. It's the first time we played together. And, man, you just know after playing a game with somebody that you're speaking the same language. You know, he was just such a great defender to have as a team guy. He was scooping up every ground ball. He was making everyone around him better. And that's what, you know, a scrapper, not the biggest cat in the world, but man, he was a great player, played with incredible energy, fearlessness, and tough. And that's the way he lived his life. You know, he's what, 50, he would be 52, I think. And he's dealt with this illness for the last, half a decade, continued to coach, continued to impact, to use lacrosse to impact so many young people in Cincinnati. It's going to be a big loss for the Tar Heel family. And, you know, I hope we can, do some tributes to him and bring his name up, anytime that the Tar Heels take the field.
I think I saw over the weekend that his motto was get busy living. And with that in mind, want to send our condolences to the Harden family, to the extended North Carolina lacrosse community, the Cincinnati lacrosse community. And well said, Coach Kesnick. Tough way to end, but really appreciate your time on a Monday morning. Enjoy the remaining time of your visit in Woodstock, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
Yes, last thing, Terry, we got some summer events coming up, not this week, but next week is NHSLS. We got Inside Lacrosse events cooking. The Under Armour's, you know, down the road, as well as Naptown. You got all sorts of wonderful summer activities now that this pandemic is subsiding. Get out there, get against the wall, play in the backyard, and we'll see you this summer. We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.